Chapter 9. To Die Well. Lan split the head of the Murdral in half down to the neck. He danced Mandar back, letting the fade thrash as it died, its convulsions twisting the pieces of its skull from the neck. Putrid black blood poured onto the rock, which had already been bloodied a dozen times.
"Lord Mandragoran!"
Lan wheeled toward the call. One of his men pointed back toward their camp, where a spout of bright red light was shooting into the air.
"Noon already?"
Lan thought, raising his sword and signaling for his Melchieri to retreat. The Kandori and Arafelan troops were swinging in, light cavalry with bows sending wave after wave of arrows into the mass of Trollocs. The stench was tremendous. Lan and his men rode away from the front lines, passing two Ashaman and an Aes Sedai, Koladera, who had insisted on staying on as King Pytar's advisor, channeling to set the Trolloc corpses aflame. That would make it more difficult for the next wave of Shadow Spawn. Lan's armies had continued their brutal work, holding the Trollocs at the gap like pitch holding back the spray of water in a leaking boat. The army fought in short rotations, an hour at a time. Bonfires and Ashaman lit the way at night, never giving the Shadowspawn the opportunity to advance. After 2 days of grueling battle, Lan knew that this tactic would eventually favor the Trollocs. Humans were killing them by the wagon load, but the Shadow had been building its forces for years. Each night the Trollocs fed upon the dead. They didn't have to worry about mess supplies. Lan kept his shoulders from sagging as he rode away from the front lines, making way for the next group of his troops, but he wanted to collapse and sleep for days. Despite the greater numbers given him by the Dragon Reborn, every man was required to take several shifts on the front lines each day. Lan always joined a few extra. Finding sleep was not easy for his troops, while also caring for their equipment, gathering wood for the bonfires, and bringing supplies through gateways. As he surveyed those leaving the front lines with him, Lan sought for what he could do to strengthen them. Nearby, a faithful Bulan was sagging. Lan would need to make sure the man slept more, or... Bulan slid from the saddle. Lan cursed, stopping Mandarb, and leaped down. He dashed to Bulan's side and found the man staring blankly into the sky. Bulan had a massive wound in his side, the mail there ripped like a sail that had seen too much wind. Bulan had covered the wound by putting his coat on over his armor. Lan hadn't seen him hit, nor had he seen the man covering up the wound.
"Fool,"
Lan thought, feeling at Bulan's neck. No pulse. He was gone.
"Fool,"
Lan thought again, bowing his head.
"You wouldn't leave my side, would you? That's why you hit it. You were afraid I'd die out there while you came back for healing. Either that or you didn't want to demand strength from the channelers. You knew they were pushed to their limits."
With teeth clenched, Lan picked up Bulan's corpse and slung it over his shoulder. He hefted the body onto Bulan's horse and tied it across the saddle. Andir and Prince Kaisel, the Kandori youth and his squad of 100 usually rode with Lan, sat nearby, watching solemnly. Conscious of their eyes, Lan put his hand on the corpse's shoulder.
"You did well, my friend," he said. "Your praises will be sung for generations. May you shelter in the palm of the Creator's hand, and may the last embrace of the Mother welcome you home."
He turned to the others.
"I will not mourn. Mourning is for those who regret, and I do not regret what we do here. Bulan could not have died a better death. I do not cry for him. I cheer."
He swung up into Mandarb's saddle, holding the reins of Bulan's horse, and sat tall. He would not let them see his fatigue, or his sorrow.
"Did any of you see Bach fall?" he asked those riding near him. "He had a crossbow tied to the back of his horse. He always carried that thing with him. I swore that if it ever went off by accident, I'd have the Ashaman hang him by his toes from the top of a cliff. He died yesterday when his sword caught in a Trolloc's armor. He left it and reached for his spear, but two more Trollocs pulled his horse out from underneath him. I thought he was dead then, and was trying to reach him, only to see him come up with that light-burned crossbow of his and shoot a Trolloc right in the eye from 2 feet away. The bolt went clear through its head. The second Trolloc gutted him, but not before he put his boot knife in its neck.
Lan nodded.
I remember you, Bok. You died well.
They rode for a few moments, and then Prince Kaisel added,
Ragan. He died well, too. Charged his horse straight at a group of 30 Trollocs that were coming in at us from the side. Probably saved a dozen men with that move, buying us time. He kicked one in the face as they pulled him down. Yes, Ragan was a right insane man,
Andir said.
I'm one of the men he saved.
He smiled.
He did die well. Light, but he did. Of course, the craziest thing I've seen these last few days is what Cragil did when fighting that Fade. Did any of you see it?
By the time they reached the camp, the men were laughing and toasting the fallen with words. Lan split off from them and took Bulan to the Ashaman. Narishma was holding open a gateway for a supply cart. He nodded to Lan.
Lord Mandragoran?
I need to put him someplace cold, Lan said, dismounting. When this is done, and Malkir is reclaimed, we will want a proper resting place for the noble fallen. Until then, I will not have him burned or left to rot. He was the first Malkyere to return to Malkyr's king.
Narishma nodded, Arafalan bells tinkling on the ends of his braids. He ushered a cart through the gateway, then held up a hand for the others to stop. He closed that gateway, then opened one to the top of a mountain. Icy air blew through. Lan took Bulan off his horse. Narishma moved to help, but Lan waved him away, grunting as he heaved the corpse up onto his shoulder. He stepped through into the snows, the biting wind sharp on his cheeks, as if someone had taken a knife to them. He laid Bulan down, then knelt and gently took the Hadore from Bulan's head. Lan would carry it into battle, so that Bulan could continue to fight, then return it to the body when the battle was through. An old Malkyere tradition.
You did well, Bulan,
Lan said softly.
Thank you for not giving up on me.
He stood up, boots crunching the snow, and strode out through the gateway, Hadori in hand. Narishma let the gateway close, and Lan asked for the location of the mountain, in case Narishma died in the fighting, so he could locate Bulan again. They wouldn't be able to preserve all of the Malkyere corpses this way, but one was better than none. Lan wrapped the leather Hadori about the hilt of his sword, just below the crossguard, and tied it tight. He handed Mandarb off to a groom, holding up a finger to the horse and meeting his dark, liquid eyes.
No more biting grooms, he growled at the stallion.
After that, Lan went looking for Lord Aglamar. He found the commander speaking with Tenobia outside the Saldaean section of the camp. Men stood with bows nearby in lines of 200 watching the skies. There had already been a number of Drakkar attacks. As Lan stepped up, the ground started to shake and rumble. The soldiers didn't cry out. They were growing used to this. The land groaned. The bare rock ground near Lan split. He jumped back in alarm as the shaking continued, watching tiny rents appear in the rock, hairline cracks. There was something profoundly wrong about the cracks. They were too dark, too deep. Though the area was still shaking, he stepped up, looking at the tiny cracks, trying to make them out in detail through the rumbling earthquake. They seemed to be cracks into nothingness. They drew the light in, sucked it away. It was as if he was looking at fractures in the nature of reality itself. The quakes subsided. The darkness within the cracks lingered for a few breaths, then faded away, the hairline fractures becoming just ordinary breaks in stone. Wary, Lan knelt down, inspecting them closely. Had he seen what he'd thought? What did it mean? Chilled, he rose to his feet and continued on his way. It is not men alone who grow tired, he thought. The mother is weakening. He hastened through the Saldaean camp. Of those fighting at the gap, the Saldaeans had the most well-kept camp, run by the stern hands of the officers' wives. Lan had left most of the Melchiori non-combatants in Faldara, and the other forces had come with few others except the warriors. That wasn't the Saldaean way. Though they normally didn't go into the Blight, the women otherwise marched with their husbands. Each one could fight with knives and would hold their camp to the death if the need arose. They had been extremely useful here in gathering and distributing supplies and tending the wounded. Tenobio was arguing tactics with Aglamar again. Lan listened as the Shinaran great captain nodded to her demands. She didn't have a bad grasp of things, but she was too bold. She wanted them to push into the Blight and take the fight to the Trolloc spawning grounds. Eventually, she noticed Lan. "Lord Mandragoran," she said, eyeing him. She was a pretty enough woman, with fire in her eyes and long black hair. "Your latest sortie was a success?"
"More Trollocs are dead," Lan said.
"We fight a glorious battle," she said with pride.
"I lost a good friend."
Tenobia paused, then looked at his eyes, perhaps searching for emotion in them. Lan didn't give any. Bulan had died well.
"The men who fight have glory," Lan said to her. "But the battle itself is not glory. It simply is."
"Lord Aglamar, a word."
Tenobia stepped aside, and Lan drew Aglamar away. The aged general gave Lan a grateful look. Tenobia watched for a moment, then stalked off with two guards following hastily at her heels.
"She'll be off into battle herself at some point if we don't watch her," Lan thought. "Her head is full of songs and stories."
Hadn't he just encouraged his men to tell those same stories? No. There was a difference. He could feel a difference. Teaching the men to accept that they might die and to revere the honor of the fallen. That was different from singing songs about how wonderful it was to fight on the front lines. Unfortunately, it took actual fighting to teach the difference. The lights end, Tenobia wouldn't do anything too rash. Lan had seen many a young man with that look in his eyes. The solution, then, was to work them to exhaustion for a few weeks, drilling them to the point that they thought only of their bed, not of the glories they would someday find. He doubted that would be appropriate for the queen herself.
"She has been growing more rash ever since Kallion married Atheniella,"
Lord Aglamar said quietly, joining Lan as they walked the back lines, nodding to passing soldiers.
"I think that he was able to dampen her a featherweight or two. But now, without him or Bashir watching her?"
He sighed.
"Well, regardless, what is it you wished of me, Darshan?"
"We fight well here," Lan said. "But I'm worried about how tired the men are. Will we be able to keep holding back the Trollocs?"
"You're right. The enemy will force its way through eventually,"
Aglamar said.
"What do we do then?" Lan asked.
"We will fight here," Aglamar said. "And then, once we cannot hold, we will retreat to buy time."
Lan stiffened.
"Retreat?"
Aglamar nodded.
"We are here to slow the Trollocs down. We will accomplish that by holding here for a time, then slowly pulling back across Shinar."
"I did not come to Tarwin's Gap to retreat, Aglamar."
"Darshan, I'm led to believe you came here to die."
That was nothing but the truth.
"I will not abandon Malkir to the Shadow a second time, Aglamar. I came to the Gap. The Malkieri followed me here to show the Dark One that we had not been beaten. To leave after we've actually been able to gain a footing."
"Darshan,"
Lord Aglamar said in a softer voice as they walked.
"I respect your decision to fight. We all do. Your march here alone inspired thousands. That may not have been your purpose, but it is the purpose the wheel wove for you. The determination of a man to set upon justice is a thing not lightly ignored. However, there is a time to put yourself aside and see the greater importance.
Lance stopped, eyeing the aged general.
Take care, Lord Aglamar. It almost sounds as if you are calling me selfish.
I am, Lan,
Aglamar said.
And you are.
Lan did not flinch.
You came to throw your life away for Malkir. That, in itself, is noble. However, with the last battle upon us, it's also stupid. We need you. Men will die because of your stubbornness.
I did not ask for them to follow me. Light, I did all that I could to stop them.
Duty is heavier than a mountain, Daishan.
That time, Lan did flinch. How long had it been since someone had been able to do that to him with mere words? He remembered teaching that same concept to a youth out of the Two Rivers. A sheepherder, innocent of the world, fearful of the fate laid out before him by the pattern.
Some men,
Aglamar said,
are destined to die and they fear it. Others are destined to live and to lead, and they find it a burden. If you wished to keep fighting here until the last man fell, you could do it, and they'd die singing the glory of the fight. Or you could do what we both need to do. Retreat when we're forced to it. Adapt, continuing delaying and stalling the shadow as long as we can. Until the other armies can send us aid. We have an exceptionally mobile force. Each army sent you their finest cavalry. I've seen 9,000 Saldae in light horse perform complex maneuvers with precision. We can hurt the shadow here, but their numbers are proving too great. Greater than I thought they would be. We will hurt more of them as we withdraw. We will find ways to punish them with every step we take backward. Yes, Lan. You made me commanding general of the field. That is my advice to you. It won't be today, or perhaps for another week, but we will need to fall back.
Lan walked on in silence. Before he could formulate a reply, he saw a blue light exploding in the air. The emergency signal from the gap. The units that had just rotated onto the field needed help.
I will consider it,
Lan thought. Pushing aside his fatigue, he dashed for the horse lines where the groom would have delivered Mandarb. He didn't need to ride on this sortie. He had just gotten off one. He decided to go anyway and caught himself yelling for Bulan to prepare a horse and felt a fool. Light, but Lan had grown accustomed to the man's help.
Aglamar is right,
Lan thought as the grooms fell over themselves saddling Mandarb. The stallion was skittish, sensing his mood.
They will follow me, like Bulan did. Leading them to death in the name of a fallen kingdom. Leading myself to the same death. How is that any different from Tenobia's attitude?
Before long, he was galloping back toward the defensive lines to find the Trollocs almost breaking through. He joined the rally, and this night they held. Eventually, they would fail to do so. What then? Then he would abandon Malkir again and do what had to be done.
Egwene's force had gathered at the southern portion of the field of Merilor. They'd been slated to travel to Kandor once Elaine's force had been dispatched to Camelon. Rand's armies had not yet entered Thakondar, but had instead moved to staging areas on the northern part of the field, where supplies could be assembled more easily. He claimed the time wasn't quite right for his assault. The light said he was making progress with the Seanchan. Moving so many people was a tremendous headache. Aes Sedai created gateways in a huge line, like the doorways along one side of a grand feast hall. Soldiers bunched up, waiting their turn to pass through. Many of the strongest channelers were not involved in this task. They would be channeling in combat soon enough, and creating gateways would only consume needed strength before the important work had begun. The soldiers made way for the Ammerlin, of course. With the four guard in place and a camp established on the other side, it was time for her to cross. She had spent the morning meeting with the hall as they went over the supply reports and terrain assessments. She was glad she had allowed the hall to take a larger role in the war. There was a great deal of wisdom to the sitters, many of whom had lived well over a century. "I don't like being forced to wait this long," Gawain said, riding beside her. She eyed him. "I trust General Bryn's battlefield assessment, as does the hall," Egwene said, as they rode past the Ileanor companions, each man's brilliant breastplate worked with the 9 bees of Ileon on the front. They saluted her, faces hidden behind their conical helmets, barred at the front. She wasn't certain she liked having them in her army. They would be more loyal to Rand than to her. But Bryn had insisted on it. He said that her force, though enormous, lacked an elite group like the companions. "I still say we should have left sooner," Gawain said, as the two of them passed through the gateway to the border of Kandor. "It has only been a few days."
"A few days while Kandor burns."
She could sense his frustration. She could also feel that he loved her, fiercely. He was her husband now. The marriage had been performed by Sylviana in a simple ceremony the night before. It still felt odd to know that Egwene had authorized her own wedding. When you were the highest authority, what else could you do? As they moved into the camp on the Kandori border, Bryn rode by, giving terse orders to scouting patrols. When he reached Egwene, he climbed out of the saddle and bowed low, kissing her ring. He then remounted and continued. He was very respectful, considering that he'd essentially been bullied into leading this army. Of course he'd made his demands and they had been met, so perhaps he'd bullied them as well. Leading the White Tower's armies had been an opportunity for him. No man liked being put out to pasture. The great captain shouldn't have found himself there in the first place. Egwene noted Swan riding at Bryn's side and smiled in satisfaction. "He is bound tightly to us now." Egwene surveyed the hills on the southeastern border of Kandor. Though they lacked greenery, like most places in the world now, their peaceful serenity gave no hint that the country beyond them burned. The capital, Chachin, was now little more than rubble. Before withdrawing to join the fight with the other borderlanders, Queen Atheniella had turned over rescue operations to Egwene and the Hall. They had done what they could, sending scouts through gateways along major roadways looking for refugees, then bringing them away to safety, if anywhere could be called safe now. The main Trolloc army had left the burning cities and was now moving southeast toward the hills and the river that made up Kandor's border with Arafel. Sylviana rode up beside Egwene, opposite Gawain. She spared him only a glare. Those two really would have to stop snapping at one another. It was growing tiresome, before kissing Egwene's ring. "Mother?"
"Sylviana?"
"We have received an update from Elaine Sedai." Egwene allowed herself a smile. Both of them, independently, had taken to calling Elaine by her White Tower title, as opposed to her civil title.
"And?"
"She suggests that we set up a location where the wounded can be sent for healing. We'd talked about having the Yellows move from battlefield to battlefield," Egwene said. "Elaine said I is worried about exposing the Yellows to attack," Sylviana said. "She wants a stationary hospital."
"That would be more efficient, Mother," Gawain said, rubbing his chin. "Finding the wounded after a battle is a brutal affair. I don't know what I'd think of sending sisters to comb through the dead. This war could stretch weeks, even months, if the great captains are right. Eventually the Shadow is going to start picking off Aes Sedai on the field.
Elaine Sedai was quite insistent, Sylviana said.
Her face was a mask, her tone steady, yet she also managed to convey severe displeasure. Sylviana was proficient at that.
I helped put Elaine in charge, Egwene reminded herself. Refusing her would set a bad precedent, as would obeying her. Perhaps they could remain friends through it.
Elaine Sedai shows wisdom, Egwene said. Tell Ramonda that it must be done this way. Have the entire Yellow Aja gather for healing, but not at the White Tower.
Mother? Sylviana asked.
The Shan Shan, Egwene said. She had to smother the serpent deep inside of her that writhed whenever she thought of them.
I will not risk the Yellows being attacked while alone and exhausted from healing. The White Tower is exposed and is a focus for the enemy. If not the Shan Shan, then the Shadow.
A valid point. Sylviana sounded reluctant. But where else?
Camelin has fallen and the borderlands are too exposed.
Tyr?
Hardly, Egwene said. That was Rand's territory, and it seemed too obvious.
Send back to Elaine with a suggestion. Perhaps the First of Mayenne will be willing to provide a suitable building, a very large one.
Egwene tapped the side of her saddle.
Send the accepted and the novices with the Yellows. I don't want those women on the battlefield, but their strength can be put to use in healing.
Linked to a Yellow, the weakest of novices could lend a trickle of strength and save lives.
Many would be disappointed. They imagined slaying Trollocs. Well, this would be a way for them to fight without getting underfoot, untrained in combat as they were.
Egwene glanced over her shoulder. Movement through the gateways would not be finished any time soon.
Sylviana, relay my words to Elaine Sedai, Egwene said. Gawain, I have something I want to do.
They found Chubane supervising the setup of a command camp in a valley west of the river that formed the boundary between Kandor and Arafel. They'd press forward into this hilly country to meet the oncoming Trollocs, deploying harrying forces in the adjoining valleys, with archers atop the hills alongside defensive units. The plan would be to strike hard at Trollocs as they tried to take the hills, doing as much damage as possible. The harrying units could swipe at enemy flanks while the defenders held the hills as long as they could. The odds were good that they would eventually be pushed out of those hills and across the border into Arafel, but on the wide plains of Arafel, their cavalries could be used to better advantage. Egwene's force, like Lan's, was meant to delay and slow the Trollocs until Elaine could defeat those in the south. Ideally, they would hold until reinforcements could arrive. Chubane saluted and led them to a tent that had already been erected nearby. Egwene dismounted and started to enter, but Gawain laid a hand on her arm. She sighed, nodded, and let him enter first. Inside, on the floor with legs folded, sat the Shanchan woman that Nynaeve had called Aginin, although the woman insisted on being called Lyalwyn. Three members of the Tower Guard watched over her and her Ilianar husband. Lyalwyn looked up as Egwene entered, then immediately rose to her knees and performed a graceful bow, forehead touching the tent floor. Her husband did as she did, though his motion seemed more reluctant. Perhaps he was merely a worse actor than she was.
Out, Egwene said to the three guards. They did not argue, though their withdrawal was slow. As if she couldn't handle herself with her warder against two people who could not channel.
Men. Gawain took up position at the side of the tent, leaving her to address the two prisoners.
Nynaeve tells me you are marginally trustworthy, Egwene said to Lyalwyn.
Oh, sit up! Nobody bows that low in the White Tower, not even the lowest of servants. Lyalwyn sat up, but she kept her eyes lowered.
I have failed greatly in the duty assigned me, and in so doing have endangered the pattern itself.
Yes, Egwene said. The bracelets, I'm aware. Would you like a chance to repay that debt? The woman bowed herself, forehead to the ground again. Egwene sighed, but before she could order the woman to rise, Lyalwyn spoke.
By the light and my hope for salvation and rebirth, Lyalwyn said, I vow to serve you and protect you, Amyrlin, ruler of the White Tower. By the crystal throne and the blood of the Empress, I bind myself to you, to do as commanded in all things, and to put your life before my own. Under the light, may it be so. She kissed the floor.
Egwene looked at her, stunned. Only a dark friend would betray an oath such as that one. Of course, every Shan Shan was close to being a dark friend. You think I'm not well protected? Egwene asked. You think that I need another servant?
I think only of repaying my debt, Lyalwyn said.
In her tone, Egwene sensed a stiffness, a bitterness. That rang of authenticity. This woman did not like humbling herself in this manner. Egwene folded her arms, troubled. What can you tell me of the Shan Shan military, its arms and strength, and of the plans of the Empress?
I know some things, Amyrlin, Lyalwyn said, but I was a ship's captain. What I do know is of the Shan Shan Navy, and that will be of little use to you.
Of course, Egwene thought. She glanced at Gawain, who shrugged.
Please, Lyalwyn said softly, allow me to prove myself to you somehow. I have little left to me. My name itself is no longer my own.
First, Egwene said, you will talk of the Shan Shan. I don't care if you think it's irrelevant. Anything you tell me might be helpful. Or it might reveal Lyalwyn as a liar, which would be equally useful. Gawain, fetch me a chair. I'm going to listen to what she says. After that, we'll see.
Rand rifled through the pile of maps, notes, and reports. He stood with his arms folded behind his back, a single lamp burning on the desk. Sheathed in glass, the flame danced as breezes eddied through the tent where he stood alone. Was the flame alive? It ate. It moved on its own. You could smother it, so in a way it breathed. What was it to be alive? Could an idea live? A world without the Dark One. A world without evil. Rand turned back to the maps. What he saw impressed him. Elaine was preparing well. He had not attended the meetings planning each battle. His attention was directed to the north, toward Sheol Ghul, his destiny, his grave. He hated the way these battle maps, with notes for formations and groups, reduced men's lives to scribbles on a page, numbers and statistics. Oh, he admitted that the clarity, the distance, was essential for a battlefield commander. He hated it nonetheless. Here before him was a flame that lived, yet here were also men who were dead. Now that he could not lead the war himself, he hoped to stay away from maps such as this one. He knew seeing these preparations would make him grieve for the soldiers he could not save. A sudden chill ran across him, the hairs on his arms standing on end, a distant shiver halfway between excitement and terror. A woman was channeling. Rand raised his head and found Elaine frozen in the tent doorway.
Light, she said. Rand, what are you doing here? Are you trying to kill me with fright?
He turned, settling his fingers on the battle maps, taking her in. Now here was life.
flushed cheeks, golden hair with a hint of honey and rose, eyes that burned like a bonfire. Her dress of crimson showed the swell of the children she bore. Light, she was beautiful.
"Randall Thor?" Elaine asked. "Are you going to talk to me, or do you wish to ogle me further?"
"If I can't ogle you, whom can I ogle?" Rand asked.
"Don't grin at me like that, farm boy," she said. "Sneaking into my tent? Really? What would people say?"
"They'd say that I wanted to see you. Besides, I didn't sneak in. The guards let me in." She folded her arms.
"They didn't tell me."
"I asked them not to."
"Then for all intents and purposes, you were sneaking."
Elaine brushed by him. She smelled wonderful.
"Honestly, as if Avienda weren't enough."
"I didn't want the regular soldiers to see me," Rand said. "I worried it would disturb your camp. I asked the guards not to mention that I was here." He stepped up to her, resting his hand on her shoulder. "I had to see you again before."
"You saw me at Marilor."
"Elaine."
"I'm sorry," she said, turning back to him. "I am happy to see you, and I am glad you came. I'm just trying to get into my head how you fit into all of this. How we fit into all of this."
"I don't know," Rand said. "I've never figured it out. I'm sorry."
She sighed, sitting down in the chair beside her desk.
"I suppose it is good to find there are some things you can't fix with a wave of your hand."
"There is much I can't fix, Elaine."
He glanced at the desk and the maps.
"So much. Don't think about that."
He knelt before her, getting a cocked eyebrow until he placed his hand on her belly, hesitantly at first.
"I didn't know," he said. "Not until just recently, the night before the meeting."
"Twins, it is said?"
"Yes."
"So Tam will be a grandfather," Rand said. "And I will be..."
How was a man supposed to react to this news? Was it supposed to shake him, upend him? Rand had been given his share of surprises in life. It seemed he could no longer take two steps without the world changing on him. But this wasn't a surprise. He found that deep down he'd hoped that someday he would be a father. It had happened. That gave him warmth. One thing was going right in the world, even if so many had gone wrong. Children. His children. He closed his eyes, breathing in, enjoying the thought. He would never know them. He would leave them fatherless before they were even born. But then Janduin had left Rand fatherless, and he had turned out all right. Just a few rough edges here and there. "What will you name them?" Rand asked.
"If there is a boy, I've been thinking of naming him Rand."
Rand let himself go still as he felt her womb. Was that motion? A kick?
"No," Rand said softly. "Please do not name either child after me, Elaine. Let them live their own lives. My shadow will be long enough as it is."
"Very well."
He looked up to meet her eyes, and he found her smiling with fondness. She rested a smooth hand on his cheek.
"You will be a fine father."
"Elaine."
"Not a word of it,"
she said, raising a finger.
"No talk of death, of duty."
"We cannot ignore what will happen."
"We needn't dwell on it either," she said. "I taught you so much about being a monarch, Rand. I seem to have forgotten one lesson. It is all right to plan for the worst possibilities, but you must not bask in them. You must not fixate on them. A queen must have hope before all else."
"I do hope," Rand said. "I hope for the world, for you, for everyone who must fight. That does not change the fact that I have accepted my own death."
"Enough," she said. "No more talk of this. Tonight I will have a quiet dinner with the man I love."
Rand sighed, but rose, seating himself in the chair beside hers as she called to the guards at the tent flap for their meal.
"Can we at least discuss tactics?" Rand asked. "I'm truly impressed by what you've done here. I don't think I could have done a better job."
"The great captains did most of it."
"I saw your annotations," Rand said. "Bashir and the others are wonderful generals, geniuses even. But they think only of their specific battles. Someone needs to coordinate them. And you are doing that marvelously. You have a head for this."
"No, I don't," Elaine said. "What I do have is a lifetime spent as the daughter heir of Andor, being trained for wars that might come. Thank General Bryn and my mother for what you see in me. Did you find anything in my notes that you would change?"
"There is more than 150 miles between Camlin and Braem Wood where you plan to ambush the Shadow," Rand noted. "That's risky. What if your forces get overrun before they reach the wood?"
"Everything depends on them beating the Trollocs to the wood. Our harrying forces will be using the strongest, fastest mounts available. It will be a grueling race, there's no question, and the horses will be near death by the time they reach the wood. But we are hoping that the Trollocs will be the worse for wear by then as well, which should make our job easier."
They talked tactics, and evening became night. Servants arrived with dinner, broth and wild boar. Rand had wished to keep his presence in the camp quiet, but there was nothing for that now that the servants knew. He settled himself to dine and let himself flow into the conversation with Elaine. Which battlefield was in the most danger? Which of the great captains should she champion when they disagreed? Which they often did. How would this all work with Rand's army, which still waited for the right time to attack Shael Ghul? The conversation reminded him of their time in Tyr, stealing hidden kisses in the stone between sessions of political training. Rand had fallen in love with her during those days. Real love. Not the admiration of a boy falling off a wall looking at a princess. Back then he hadn't understood love any more than a farm boy swinging a sword understood war. Their love was born of the things they shared. With Elaine he could speak of politics and the burden of rule. She understood. She truly did, better than anyone he knew. She knew what it was to make decisions that changed the lives of thousands. She understood what it was to be owned by the people of a nation. Rand found it remarkable that, though they had often been apart, their connection held. In fact, it felt even stronger, now that Elaine was queen, now that they shared the children growing within her.
"You wince," Elaine said.
Rand looked up from his broth. Elaine's dinner was half finished. He had been making her speak a great deal. She seemed through anyway and held a warm cup of tea.
"I what?" Rand asked.
"You wince. When I mentioned the contingents fighting for Andor, you flinched just a little."
It was not surprising, she had noticed. Elaine had been the one to teach him to watch for minor tells in the expressions of those with whom he spoke.
"All of these people fight under my name," Rand said. "So many people I do not even know will die for me."
"That has ever been the burden of a ruler at war."
"I should be able to protect them," Rand said.
"If you think you can protect everyone, Rand Althor, you are far less wise than you pretend."
He looked at her, meeting her eyes. "I don't believe I can, but their deaths weigh on me. I feel as if I should be able to do more, now that I remember. He tried to break me, and he failed."
"Is that what happened that day atop Dragonmount?"
He hadn't spoken of it to anyone. He pulled his seat closer to hers.
"Up there, I realized that I had been thinking too much on strength. I wanted to be hard, so hard. In driving myself so, I risked losing the ability to care. That was wrong. For me to win, I must care. That, unfortunately, means I must allow myself pain at their deaths."
"And you remember Luz Theron now?"
she whispered.
"Everything he knew? That is not just an air you put on?
I am him. I always was. I remember it now.
Elaine breathed out, eyes widening.
What an advantage!
Of all the people he had told that to, only she had responded in such a way.
What a wonderful woman.
I have all this knowledge, yet it doesn't tell me what to do.
He stood up, pacing.
I should be able to fix it, Elaine. No more should need to die for me. This is my fight. Why must everyone else go through such suffering?
You deny us the right to fight, she said, sitting up straight.
No, of course not, Rand said. I could deny you nothing. I just wished that somehow I could make this all stop. Shouldn't my sacrifice be enough?
She stood, taking his arm. He turned to her. Then she kissed him.
I love you, she said. You are a king. But if you would try to deny the good people of Andor the right to defend themselves, the right to stand in the last battle?
Her eyes flared, her cheeks flushed.
Light.
His comments had truly made her angry. He never quite knew what she was going to say or do, and that excited him. Like the excitement of watching night flowers, knowing that what was to come would be beautiful, but never knowing the exact form that beauty would take.
I said I wouldn't deny you the right to fight, Rand said. It's about more than just me, Rand. It's about everyone. Can you understand that?
I suppose that I can.
Good.
Elaine settled back down and took a sip of her tea, then grimaced.
It's gone bad? Rand asked.
Yes, but I'm used to it. Still, it's almost worse than drinking nothing at all with how spoiled everything is.
Rand walked to her and took the cup from her fingers. He held it for a moment, but did not channel.
I brought you something. I forgot to mention it.
Tea?
No, this is just an aside.
He handed the cup back to her and she took a sip. Her eyes widened.
It's wonderful. How do you do it?
I don't, Rand said, sitting. The pattern does.
But...
I'm Tuviran, Rand said. Things happen around me. Unpredictable things. For the longest time, there was a balance. In one town, someone would discover a great treasure unexpectedly under the stairs. In the next I visited, people would discover that their coins were fakes, passed to them by a clever counterfeiter. People died in terrible ways. Others were saved by a miracle of chance. Deaths and births, marriages and divisions. I once saw a feather drift down from the sky and fall point first into the mud so it stuck there. The next 10 that fell did the same thing. It was all random. 2 sides to a flipping coin.
This tea is not random.
Yes, it is, Rand said. But you see, I get only one side of the coin these days. Someone else is doing the bad. The Dark One injects horrors into the world, causing death, evil, madness. But the pattern is balance. So it works through me to provide the other side. The harder the Dark One works, the more powerful the effect around me becomes.
The growing grass, Elaine said. The splitting clouds. The food unspoiled?
Yes.
Well, some other tricks helped on occasion, but he didn't mention them. He fished in his pocket for a small pouch.
If what you say is true, Elaine replied, then there can never be good in the world.
Of course there can.
Will the pattern not balance it out?
He hesitated. That line of reasoning cut too close to the way he had begun thinking before Dragonmount. That he had no options, that his life was planned for him.
So long as we care, Rand said, there can be good. The pattern is not about emotions. It is not even about good or evil. The Dark One is a force from outside of it, influencing it by force.
And Rand would end that, if he could.
Here, Rand said.
The gift I mentioned. He pushed the pouch toward her. She looked at him, curious. She untied the strings and took from it a small statue of a woman. She stood upright, with a shawl about her shoulders, though she did not look like an Aes Sedai. She had a mature face, aged and wise, with a wise look about her and a smile on her face.
"An Angreal?" Elaine asked.
"No. A seed."
"A seed?"
"You have the talent of creating Tirangreal," Rand said. "Creating Angreal requires a different process. It begins with one of these, an object created to draw your power and instill it into something else. It takes time and will weaken you for several months, so you should not attempt it while we are at war. But when I found it, forgotten, I thought of you. I had wondered what I could give you."
"Oh, Rand, I have something for you as well."
She hurried over to an ivory jewelry chest that rested on a camp table and took a small object from it. It was a dagger with a short, dull blade and a handle made of deer horn wrapped in gold wire. Rand glanced at the dagger quizzically. "No offense, but that looks like a poor weapon, Elaine."
"It's a Tirangreal, something that may be of use when you go to Shale Ghul. With it, the shadow cannot see you."
She reached up to touch his face. He placed a hand on hers. They stayed together long into the night.